Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT Photo, episode number 65, with Catherine Hall and Leo Laporte, recorded on July 10th, 2012. Landscape photographer Michael Fry.
TWiT Photo is brought to you by Audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/TWiT Photo. It's time for TWiT Photo, the show that covers the art and science of photography and how you can be a better photographer, with our host, Catherine Hall. Good to see you, Catherine. CatherineHall.net is the website. And we should say, we have a couple of announcements. First of all, and I know people know this by now, but I'm sad to say, reiterate the fact that we've got two more TWiT photos, this one and the next one.
Yes, two more.
And but
and
then
I was
you're
so
taking,
excited I couldn't sleep last night.
You've got a good idea.
Yes, I do.
Tell us about your good idea.
Well, I have to say, one of the most saddening aspects of TWiT Photo ending was just losing contact with the community. And there was such a reach out with everyone on Twitter and Google Plus and email.
People love this show.
And I love this show. I love doing this show. And I didn't want it to end. So I'm moving on, Leo.
Yeah?
I'm moving on.
Yeah?
So if you want to pull up my blog, there is a little announcement there.
CatherineHall.net/blog. We're going to have to get you to do that there, Brian, because I don't have the, I can't broadcast anything.
Roger that. But anyway, it just explains sort of my transition and my thought process and everything. But I'm incredibly excited to announce that I'm going to be doing my own show.
Photography Unfiltered, is that what you're going to call it?
That's what it's called.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
We're going to do it on Tuesdays to keep it somewhat consistent. I'm not sure the timing yet. But
now, I suggested to Catherine that she not do it live.
Yes.
Because that
baby
adds
steps.
A lot of, yeah, baby steps. Sometime, at some point, I'm sure you'll get to live. And you could have a hangout going or something like that while you're doing it.
Yeah, I mean, that's
live
my
really
biggest,
adds to the complexity.
My biggest concern is obviously losing Leo.
No, you don't need me. I lost you, not you losing me.
But then also just the quality that I have become accustomed to. So there will be a little bit of a growing pain with that. But
well, the good news
that,
is
the content's going to be great. And one of the best things throughout this process is I really got a lot of feedback from viewers. Oh, yeah, you could go to photography-unfiltered.com. You can see the site.
Yeah.
I got a lot of feedback from viewers, and the show is going to evolve and change in a way that's satisfying the viewers out there. So
that's the
I'm
way to do it.
I'm excited to do that.
It's all about the community.
It's definitely going to be a lot more community-driven and a lot more how-tos in bringing Ryan in, who's going to be co-hosting with me.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So
great.
A lot more sort of, he's a gear gadget tech guy, so satisfying that part of the audience as well. So
I was very much hoping that you would do that, and I'm really glad, and we'll be glad to help you in any way, and certainly we'll point people
to
it.
But yeah, Brian, if you hit the homepage, you can kind of see the mission statement and all of it.
So Photography Unfiltered. Now, we got one more show next week, and then...
Yes, we do. And then this show's going to be rolling out in August.
In August, we'll start.
Yes.
And we'll make sure everybody knows about it.
And I'm jumping on it.
Good.
I'm doing the best I can, trying to make sure there's no delay. And yes, Ryan is TWiT's very own gaffer.
Yeah, Ryan Marsh. You're lucky, because your boyfriend happens to be a very good production guy. There he is. And he's, besides, a hell of a good-looking fella. of course, he's a very good production guy, and so it'll be great to have him both as a host.
Yeah, and he loves teaching too.
Yeah,
so
he's good. So that's great. I'm excited.
Yeah, so
he's much better than me. Much better.
Look forward to it.
Yeah.
No.
But I'm glad you're going to do that. I think that's great. Now let's talk about our guest, because I am very excited, because one of my favorite places in the world, we're not so far away, is Yosemite Valley, the national park.
Yes,
it is totally gorgeous, and our guest today spends his time photographing. In fact, lives just outside of Yosemite.
Yes, he does.
Let's welcome Michael.
Michael, thank you so much.
Fry, F-R-Y-E.
People have been asking for you.
Great.
And so it's a great honor to have you here.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, good to
have you. So you came to Yosemite when you were 25 years old, and here we are. Yeah. It looks like you're a little older.
Yeah.
Tell me about how did this all come to be? How did you end up doing photography, mainly focusing on landscapes in Yosemite?
Well, I actually got a job in Yosemite back in the early 80s. And at that time, I was probably more interested in rock climbing than photography. And, you know, I went hiking and rock climbing and all that kind of stuff. But after having spent a few years there, I got more and more into photography. So the two really kind of went together. And I think my interest in nature and photography grew together. You know, I was interested in nature, so I wanted to show what I was seeing, the beautiful things I was seeing out there. And so that really got me more interested in it. And I got a job after a couple of years in the park. I got a job at the Ansel Adams Gallery, working as one of their staff photographers. And that was a great education for me. So just meeting lots of great photographers and looking at lots of wonderful photographs by Ansel and other people as well. And
it does have to be a little intimidating because you're following in the footsteps of some of the greatest American photographers.
Yeah. I would say he's probably the most well-known photographer.
Ansel Adams.
Yeah. History.
I would, in this country at least, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, at first that was intimidating, I think. And maybe that's one of the reasons why when I first started out and doing photography seriously and started selling photographs, I was mostly doing wildlife. I was very into animals and doing wildlife.
You're not going to do Half Dome
away. I'll do some other things. But as time went on, I gravitated more to doing landscapes, and I really didn't worry about that anymore. I mean, I was just doing my own thing, still am, and not worried about whether, you know, someone else has photographed that scene before or whatever. You know, I just try to do what pleases me.
What is it about Yosemite that draws you?
Oh, my God. I mean, well, it's just such a beautiful place. You know, I lived right in Yosemite Valley for over 20 years, and so got this really sort of intimate acquaintance with it and all the changes and the seasons. And so I really love the place. It's, you know, it's my home, I think, at this point. And so, you know, I think anyone who's been there understands the appeal.
It's gorgeous.
Of the place.
But you have another, you have an advantage because you're there all the time, year round.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know, big part of landscape photography is being in the right place at the right time. You know, there's an element of luck, and it just helps to be in close proximity to the place. I mean, when I was living right in the valley, I live about an hour away right now, but when I was living in the valley, I could, you know, look out my window and go, oh, you know, the clouds look kind of interesting. Maybe I'll go out and see what's happening. So that was great. But
so is there a time that there is actually a downtime in Yosemite where there's less traffic? Or is it always
less
pretty much, you know, like, I mean, it's such a tourist attraction.
Well, wintertime,
You know, how do you avoid?
But there's still the Bracebridge dinner, and there's the Wawona Lodge where people go in the snow. And I mean, it is a year-round park in many ways.
It is, but it's much less crowded in the wintertime.
Yeah, the summer's when it's
summer. And winter is probably my favorite season to photograph because there's more interesting weather, more storms, snow. You know, clearing storms are the best. You know, if you're in Yosemite Valley, if you can catch it when a storm's clearing and there's mist rising along the cliffs, that's perfect.
Look at like this.
Like
it's
that.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, those of us who are in Yosemite, we hope for days like that. And they don't come that often, but once in a while.
Once in a while you get something like that.
So, I mean, if someone was planning, they wanted to come to Yosemite and they wanted to explore and photograph this incredibly beautiful place. Mm. Winter's a good time to come, but how long should they? I mean, the winter is obviously a little bit risky, being that it might be socked in the whole time.
Or yeah.
How long should someone plan their trip?
Well, long enough. You know, if you plan on coming in winter for 1 or 2 days, it could be raining or snowing the whole time. So I would try to plan, you know, a week or at least 5 days, so you have a good chance of getting some interesting weather during that time. If you're a photographer, you know, that's what you're looking for. And even same thing in spring and fall. I mean, the longer you can spend, the better. I can't believe sometimes that there are people who come in and they, you know, their first visit to the park and they have like 2 hours, you know, and that's just, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
So, you know, so the longer the better. And you know, it helps to do a little bit of advanced planning and research about some of the places you might want to photograph, you know, with the book that you mentioned and other resources. Just looking at other people's photos on Flickr or whatever can give you some great ideas about where are some of the best spots to go.
Well, we should mention, so you have a Yosemite photo guide. It's an iPad and iPhone app, $4.99 on the store. Let me do the size limitations. Okay. But when you connect, you get bigger quality images. So this is on the iPad. And then this is coming out soon, which is great.
Yeah. That's the second edition of the Photographer's Guide to Yosemite. So it's all been revised and updated, new locations, new information about, you know, all the locations. Because I've learned a lot since the book first came out about, you know, when and where the best light is and the best photo opportunities are.
That's what's nice about this app. You've got sunrise, sunset times. You've got maps. You've mm-hmm. got tips, mm-hmm. places to go. You have mm-hmm. one of the, you know, in the book you have the locations. But here also on the app, too, the best month to take a photograph, say, of Horsetail Falls. Right. It's February in the evening.
Yeah, for $4.99, it's kind of a no-brainer.
That's great. 5 to 30 minutes before sunset, especially around February 16th to 23rd. You couldn't get more specific than that.
That was pretty precise.
I know.
A friend and I kind of had a debate about, okay, when is really the best time to photograph Horsetail Falls? So I've kind of taken it on as a science project to figure out, okay, what's the best time? That's my current
And that's your scientific estimate. You
know, so for $4.99, if you're going to Yosemite, you get this app on your iPhone.
I mean, that's
or
a gold mine.
For sure.
That's
yeah.
a gold mine. So in this book, top three, I'm putting on the spot, top three places in Yosemite, if you're going, you must photograph.
Well, number one on the list has to be Tunnel View. I mean, that's the classic Yosemite view.
The
thing about Tunnel View is, though, that it takes just the right conditions. On a clear, sunny day, it's impressive visually standing there if you've never been there before, but as a photograph, it just doesn't work. So
that always happens to me. I see these beautiful things in my head, and the picture, it's like, well, that was nice. But you were looking for dramatic light, this shift. Look at that. That's gorgeous.
That's a tunnel view photograph.
Gorgeous.
And you know, another one of those instances when I was lucky enough to be there when a storm is clearing and there's that great mist and all that. So, you know, with the right light and clouds, it can be spectacular, and that would be, you know, that's got to be someplace you at least want to see and take a snapshot of. And if you get lucky, then you'll get some great light.
Right.
Well, as far as mist is concerned, any tips on capturing mist? Besides using a zoom lens, I'm sure that's probably one of them.
Sometimes. Be quick, because it changes fast. You know?
Yeah.
Be prepared. You know, be prepared to wait, too. You know, you could be standing at tunnel view, and it could be just completely socked in. You know, you can't see 100 feet in front of you, and then that'll break. I mean, and the moment when that breaks, that could be spectacular. So you have to have some patience, too. So.
And then patience, waiting. That's what photography is, right? On average, how often? I mean, what's the ballpark figure? How long are you waiting for these shots?
I'm not waiting around all day long, but I might wait at a place like Tunnel View for a couple hours if I think the conditions are promising.
For a shot like this, did you go there and say, I know this will look great? No, you didn't.
No.
I'll come back when the sun is setting?
This was fairly spontaneous.
It's a gorgeous,
you know,
shot
just I thought, oh, I should go over there. That could be a good spot, and it turned out to be. So
that's another thing good photographers do. They get up early.
Yeah.
I guess I'm a bad photographer.
I know.
I hate getting up early. I'm a night owl, actually. So for a landscape photographer, that's not a good combination. But I force myself to get up sometimes. So,
but when you're going earlier, you're getting up in dark, so you're there when it's rising.
Yeah. You usually have to be where you want to be before the sun's coming up.
This is another classic shot, Bridal Veil Falls. Everybody mm-hmm. shoots that as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, gorgeous, gorgeous.
Yeah. But yeah, that's from Tunnel View, and one of the amazing things about that viewpoint is that there's this waterfall that seems to come out of nowhere.
Right. Yeah.
That makes it.
And I love it. You got the light hitting it. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, that was you know, again, just one of those lucky, special moments that sometimes you get, you know. But luck. You have more luck the more time you spend out there.
Are these all tripod shots, or do you do handheld too? Or?
Almost all tripod. Once in a while, I'll handhold something. So, but almost always on the tripod.
So you have your tripod.
I do have my tripod.
Maybe you could walk us through, for landscape photographers, what should they be looking for in a tripod purchase?
Okay, great. Well, I think...
Purchase.
Let me make sure my wire doesn't get caught here.
You're going to be headless if you're standing.
Yeah, just move it over. Okay. Move it over in front of you and sit back down, and then we'll get a better shot.
That I can sit for the first part of this.
Okay.
Here,
we can get a camera on you later.
You want a tripod that... one of the things that I look for is I want it to be able to go low, and I want it to be able to go high. Yeah. So you'll notice that this, let's see if we can see that there, that this doesn't have a center post, which means that I can spread the legs out and get it.
Oh, so you can get it pretty much ground level.
Flat on the ground.
Mine has a center post.
Yep. I thought I had the same one.
Well, you know, there are certainly advantages to center posts.
It's easy to get a level shot because I can...
This is the Gitzo 1325 for people that are curious.
Yeah,
Catherine and I both have this tripod.
Yeah.
We love that.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. And, of course, you want it to be able to go up high. Let's see if we can get that. Great.
Oh, nice.
And the Gitzo has nice quick release, which is one of the reasons people
quick
love
release.
It.
Yep. You know, a quick release... You've got to have a quick release, otherwise it's just a pain to get the camera off and on.
Yeah.
But I also think that some of the kind of cheap quick releases are a real source of problems.
Because they
can get loose, and then the camera twists, and or if you have it tilted vertically, it'll sag downward and so forth. So I'm going to put this up.
Look how high this goes. Holy cow.
I actually don't have this quite all the way up as high as it'll go, almost. But you can see that it goes to my eye level without the center post. So I want it to be able to go low, and I want it to be able to go high. And, you know, a lot of people have tripods that aren't high enough.
Right.
And they end up, bending over like this to look through the viewfinder, which makes it impossible to get a straight horizon. You know, if you're looking at the camera sideways, you can't get the horizon straight. Also, it's bad for your back, so... So you want something that's going to go high, and I want something that's going to go low, too. And without the center post is ideal. You mentioned the quick release. You want something that's not going to twist. You know, I think most pros that I know have ball heads like this. This is kind of an ancient one, an Arca Swiss one that's 20 years old, I think. But it still works well. I think, though, that maybe my next head is going to be a geared head. I've had a couple of workshop students who have the Bogan geared head, and it works really well for landscapes. It's not as quick, so it doesn't work for wildlife or sports or things like that. But for for landscapes, it allows you to just turn a knob to really fine tune the composition, where you can just straighten it slightly or go slightly down or left or right. So that might be my next tripod head.
So people typically will buy a tripod separately from the head, then.
Well, when you get the more advanced, expensive models, they are. Of course, you want the tripod to be sturdy. I think a fairly obvious one. Carbon fiber is a great choice for lightweight yet sturdy. And of course, you pay for that, but it's worth it.
There are Gitzo knockoffs that are a lot less expensive that are pretty good.
Yeah, there are some good things out there.
Yeah.
My friend Mike Osborne likes to say that people could save themselves a lot of money if they just bought a good tripod to begin with. Most people
right.
buy a cheap, flimsy
That's exactly
one.
What I did. Right? I've gone through four cheap tripods,
right.
and I finally said, I'm buying
exactly.
a Gitzo.
You do that, and then you finally buy a good one, and in the long run, you could just save yourself some money if you just got a good one to start with.
How long have you had that one for? They last a
long I've had this
time.
One maybe...
If you don't,
6 years
if you don't leave them in Norway, they last a really long
time. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. That's not the disposable. Okay, so now I'm going to ask the obvious question.
Mm.
So obviously, in a lot of these situations, there is plenty of light.
Mm.
So why the necessary?
Great question. Couple of things. I think first of all, having the camera on a tripod allows you to do some things you couldn't otherwise do. One of those is, for example, to use slow shutter speed to let the water blur and yet have everything else in the picture sharp. You can't do that without a tripod. Also, to get more depth of field, to get everything in focus.
Here's maybe, a perfect example, yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
you have to stop down to, F-16 or F-22 to get a lot of depth of field, to get everything in focus. And that may necessitate having a slow shutter speed. Right. So with the tripod, you don't have to worry about that.
Right.
And also, I think, allows you to really sort of study your composition, you know, rather than just, oh, you know, that looks about right, but just, you know, take some time to look through the viewfinder and see, is this exactly what I want?
So, yeah, that's actually one of my favorite things of tripods.
Yeah.
It just slows you down.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Which is fine for landscapes because it ain't going anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, you know, yes and
or
no.
Or maybe.
Sometimes
the
light's changing really
quick
and you have to react. But there are a lot of situations where you can take your time.
Right.
So light is huge for you. And you've,
well, of course,
on many occasions, mentioned that that's your medium, if you will.
Yeah.
So explain to me how the study of light and documentation of light has affected your work.
Light is photography. You know, light is the medium that we're using. You know, we're not photographing things. We're photographing the light reflected off of objects. And you can have a great subject, but if the light's not good, it's probably not going to make a good photograph. On the other hand, you can have an ordinary subject, and if the light's good, or at least the light fits it, it can make a great photograph. So light's really everything. I remember reading a Cole Weston quote, something about, you know, if you don't understand light, you may as well forget about it.
It is writing with light, after all.
Yeah.
It's a
that's really what it's all about.
Yeah.
So light is obviously really crucial. And I think light can convey mood and feeling, which is really, you know, that's really primarily what I'm after. You know, I would love to just make a photograph that looks beautiful, but even more a photograph that captures a feeling or a mood that conveys what it felt like to be there. I think ultimately that's sort of what we're all after. You know, we'd like to make photographs that really communicate something besides what something looked like. So
I think that's the difference between an artistic photograph versus like a postcard shot. Remember when I was
absolutely.
First getting started, people would say, oh, your photographs look like postcards. I'm like,
that's kind of
that's like the worst insult.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a compliment. And it is. It's that difference between kind of taking it at face value and going beyond that and really inducing, creating a mood and creating a reaction from people so they feel like they're there and they can feel it.
Yeah.
I think, you know, what you just said, if you don't understand light, forget about it. I think that could be somewhat discouraging for some people because you don't always know. I mean, for me, with photography, I did not understand light in the beginning. And I understood expression and composition and color and all those things, but light was really hard for me. Mm. And it took me really having to push myself and using light modifiers like reflectors and all these things to sort of understand the difference that it can make. Did you always understand light, and how did you learn the language?
Great question. I don't know how I learned it other than just trying it, you know, trial and error. And I think, you know, I wish there had been some tutorial out there that told me exactly, you know, what to look for. I mean, certainly there are books, and I write about it in you know, some of my books and things about, you know, what to look for. But mainly just, you know, experience and trial and error, the way I think everyone learns it, honestly. You know, I can give people, you know, a few basics, you know, like it really it's not that the light has to always be extraordinary. I mean, if it is, great, you know, you have a great opportunity for a photograph, but sometimes kind of ordinary light, like just overcast light, can work very well. It just has to match the subject. So that's really what you're trying to do. You're trying to match the light to the subject. And if you're talking about nature photography, where you usually don't have any control over the light, you just have to try to put yourself in the right place at the right time, either decide, you know, this is the photograph that I want, what would be the best time to come back and get the light that would complement it. Or you can say, this is the light I've got today. You know, let's say it's overcast. What might work with that? And you can go from there. So so speaking of that, you know, overcast, soft light usually works great for colorful subjects, color contrast. And same with front light, really, where the light's at your back. And so the sun's hitting the front of the subject you're looking at, so it's pretty even lighting. Both of those situations, the lighting's even, and that helps to bring out colors and color contrast. Side light is great for texture. Sand dunes, rocks, tree bark, anything that's textured. Backlight, it's more difficult to work with in some ways, but it's rewarding if you do, because you can get translucence light shining through things from behind and great silhouettes and shapes with it. So they're very, real quick sort of ideas about some of the ways to match light and subject.
Do you gravitate towards one? Where's the sun usually when you're shooting?
Well, for smaller scenes, it's often in the shade. For for bigger landscapes, you usually need to have some sun somewhere. And there, it really could be anything. It could be front light, side light, back light. But it has to have some contrast. Without contrast, the photograph is flat and boring. So you need to have some contrast. So you need to have some light and shade, some sort of juxtaposition of light and dark.
Some depth.
Yeah.
Seems like you have a real advantage by, and maybe this is something we can all learn a little bit from, finding a subject, Yosemite, and learning by trying different things over and over again. I think sometimes I take too many different kinds of pictures, landscapes and people, and maybe if you pick one subject and you work with it, you can learn better and fill in these gaps in your knowledge. You think
sure.
There's a little advantage.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to be said for focusing on something and learning it more, but photography should be fun, so you want to do what's fun, and if that means photographing a whole bunch of different things, then sure, why not? There's no law that says that you have to do just one thing or you have to have a certain style or any of that. You can do whatever's fun for you.
Right.
But for some people, the satisfaction is part of the satisfaction is learning to get better at doing something that they love.
And maybe just for a week, but finding something that you just spend a lot of, maybe even just one object and trying different things until you feel like you've actually captured it might be an interesting discipline,
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm sure you've taken this shot, the tunnel shot, many, 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 many times.
Yeah, and I've...
And do you learn things every time?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. Part of what I learn, part of what I learn is weather patterns. Mm-hmm. So when you're... I think I'm lucky enough to be able to live near such an extraordinary place.
No kidding.
But everybody has beautiful places somewhere nearby. And if you can get to know some of those places, you can learn the weather patterns and the seasons and take advantage of those.
Become an old timer.
Yeah. So we've talked about light, which is a key element of photography, and then composition is another one. And I think one of the challenges for especially emerging photographers when they're doing landscapes is they're in this scene, and it's so majestic, and it's so beautiful. It's hard to isolate.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what do you want to include? What don't you include in?
Yeah.
And what's a general mistake that you see photographers that are new making, and how do they grow to know exactly how to isolate?
Yeah, great question, and maybe one of the most difficult things to learn in photography, and it's not just new photographers. I think the most common mistake in that people make, not only in landscapes but in any genre, is just including too much in the frame. Kind of having this idea that if I just point the camera out there and show everything, then something good will come out of it, and it doesn't work that way. So you really have to make a conscious decision to try to find the essence of what it is you're photographing. Ask yourself, what is it that caught your eye in the first place? And whatever that is, that's what you want to make the photograph about. And get rid of everything else. It's about...
That's hard with landscape. You've got a wide-angle lens. You've got a lot of stuff.
And you're in Yosemite, where it's like 360.
You want everything.
Well, first of all...
There's a good example, though.
I have some examples that I can show. But first of all...
it's a great color.
I think that...
You know what? Let's take a break. And when we come back, let's address this.
Yeah, no problem.
Because that's a great subject.
Okay.
Yeah. And it is a big problem I have. My landscape...
You want to include everything,
pictures
don't you,
all
Leo?
Look like mush.
Mush?
Too much stuff. Overdone. Hey, let's talk a little bit about Audible.com. We're talking about Michael's great books. Now, photography books probably aren't great on Audible.com because it's all audio. But... they are great if you want to listen to fiction, nonfiction, history, mysteries, thrillers, 50 Shades of Grey. Audible has it. 100,000 titles. And you can get your first book free. All you have to do is go to audiblepodcast.com/twitphoto. audiblepodcast.com/twitphoto. You'll be signing up for that gold account. That's a book a month, and your first month's free. Your first credit is free. And the book is yours to keep, cancel at any time, pay nothing if you choose. You won't want to, though. I can tell you, there's so many great books on audible.com. It's almost an unlimited selection of Sherlock Holmes. You like Sherlock Holmes, Brian? Are you a big... Yeah. If you're watching the BBC Sherlock Holmes that just came out, or maybe the Robert Downey Jr. movies, you know, I feel for our kids today. They don't know the original Sherlock Holmes. By the way, this is a great use for Audible, is young adults, children. They have books for every age at audible.com. And these are so well read, they're so nicely done, that it will turn a kid on to reading. Sometimes people say, oh, no, I want them to read in real books. Hey, this is reading. It's a real book. Every word is there. And a lot of times, kids discover books and discover literature from listening to Audible. And for those of us who wish we had more time to read, there's nothing like it. When, you know, you're at the gym or you're in the car driving or walking the dog, I walk Ozzy, I listen to Audible books because it's a great way to get reading done. I get a couple of hours a day that I wouldn't be able to read otherwise, thanks to Audible. It's kept me in the game, so to speak. A love of reading, I tell you. That's what Audible's all about.
When you're driving to Yosemite, when you're waiting for the light to change.
Long drive, I got to tell you. audiblepodcast.com/twitphoto. Get a book. There are books in there. It will get you all the way to Yosemite and back.
The thing that's crazy to me is the selection, how just they have everything, even niche stuff, which is great.
Yeah. So here's your chance. Free book, audiblepodcast.com/twitphoto. Somebody's saying, I wish Harry Potter was an audiobook back in the day. It actually was. The great Jim Dale does an amazing job with Harry Potter. Those are Audible books, but Apple has an exclusive in the iTunes store. So I can't give you a free Harry Potter book, but that is a great way to listen to Harry Potter. And you know who did them in the UK? Stephen Fry. Those are great. Yeah, see. But they, you know, click that link. See, click your videos, because they have other good Harry Potter-like stuff, like The Hunger Games. The Lightning Thief is so good. The Alchemist. These are great titles that are also, the kids are going to love them. I read the Aragon trilogy. That is an amazing, amazing trilogy. That was written by a teenager. That guy was a teenager when he wrote
those. Are you
serious? Yeah. Wow. audiblepodcast.com/twitphoto. Try it right now. Right now. All right. I want some examples of how to eliminate the inessential from my landscape. Because I do a lot of landscapes, as you know, Catherine. I love landscape photography.
Okay. Well, I've got something on my screen here. It's a photograph of Half Dome. Mm. And, you know, I sometimes think about how many photographs people have taken of Half Dome over the years. I mean, there must be millions. And I suspect that most of them aren't very good. And part of the reason...
You've seen my portfolio, have you? Yes.
You saw my postcards?
part of the reason for that is I think, you know, someone is standing there, you know, taking a picture of Half Dome and not thinking about everything that's in the frame. You know, they might have a wide-angle lens on, and Half Dome is just a small piece of the frame, and there's all this other stuff going on. You know, there's sky, trees, you know, there might be, you know, bus going by, whatever. There's all this other stuff that they're not thinking about. So, you know, as I said, you want to try to figure out what it is that caught your eye in the first place and make the photograph about that, fill the frame with that. And if it's Half Dome, then great. You know, zoom in on it and fill the frame with it. You know, here's
now you're still shooting wide. You don't use it.
Oh, well, I use telephoto lenses all the time.
You do.
In landscapes. Absolutely. And that, I think that's kind of a, you know, almost a myth that, you know, wide angle or landscape equals wide angle. You know, and many of the world's greatest landscape photographs were made with telephoto lenses. I mean, I can think of, you know, Moon and Half Dome by Ansel, for example, is a great example. That was a 250-millimeter lens on medium format.
Wow.
So, you know, telephotos can isolate things, which is a great thing in landscapes as well as any other type of situation. You know, of course, you need wide angles too, but you know, just I wouldn't restrict yourself to just using a wide angle lens with landscapes. So,
well, that's a good example. That Moon and Half Dome. It's just the Moon and Half Dome. It's a very simple, stark photo.
Right. Yeah. And that's the power of it, is the simplicity.
Exactly.
So, you know, in this photograph, I felt that the light and the clouds were enough that I didn't need anything else. So I filled up most of the frame with Half Dome. You know, you can have juxtapositions, right? So here's a Half Dome and a cloud but it's still, it's very simple. It's just two things and really nothing much else going on in the frame. Another juxtaposition. Mm. Half Dome again, although it's really a, you know, almost a, just an accent here. But it's Half Dome and the juxtaposition of the dogwood flowers and branches in the foreground. So again, it's really simple. I eliminated, you know, whatever else I could from the frame to just make it about those two things. And that's really what you want to try to do. So, you know, here's an example of a photo that I think didn't work so well. You know, this was kind of my first attempt. And I really liked El Capitan up there in the mist. And there was this interesting ice pattern down below. But the two didn't work together all that well, I thought. In fact, one of the big problems is that there's this horizontal line.
That's like a layer
going,
cake.
I don't know if you see my mouse here. Yeah, you can. Yeah. But there's this horizontal line going right through the middle of the frame, which splits it in half. So it's really kind of two photos stuck together.
Like that.
And that's
that's
one of those classic examples where, you know, I was just trying to do too much.
Right.
And so when you find yourself in that situation, you say, you know, I'm not sure that this is really working, then maybe it's better to stick to one thing, you know, just El Cap or just the ice. So I decided to focus on the ice
at
a little bit different angle. And I think, you know, for me that works better
as a photograph
than the first one.
So taking a picture is as much as choosing what not to take a picture of
as what to take a picture of. You know, if you're a painter, you're starting with a blank canvas and adding things to it.
Yeah.
If you're a photographer, you're starting with the whole universe, an infinite universe, and you're picking one little piece of it out and saying, here, look at this.
That's the magic of photography.
Absolutely, yeah.
You're drawing somebody to look at something specific in a much larger palette.
You're very inspiring.
I love that.
Throwing that out there.
I love that.
Here's another example. I think this works pretty well. But the dark rocks at the bottom of the frame bothered me a little bit. You know, I took this picture. I looked at it on the back of my camera. You know, this was taken digitally. It's one of my first digital pictures, really, back in the day. And I looked at it on the back of the camera, and I thought, you know, what's really catching my eye is that reflection at the top of the frame and this kind of streams of water coming over. So I zoomed in more and focused just on that. So, again, I think that's simpler and stronger. Same idea here. You know, this is a nice photograph of Vernal Fall.
It's a postcard.
Exactly. Yep. You know, it shows what it looks like. It didn't capture to me what, you know, kind of what it felt like to stand there. And so... So I asked myself, you know, what is it that's really, you know, catching my eye? What is it that I think is most interesting? And it was the texture of the water, the spray. So I zoomed in on just a section of that, which I think has a little bit more impact. So now these are all sort of examples of, you know, zooming in with a long lens. So they're, you know, they're landscapes, but they're more, you know, abstract or details. The same principle applies to, you know, to bigger landscapes too. If you're, I tend to find that I'm getting the wide-angle lens out when the light's really good, you know, where the clouds are really interesting, and the sort of the big scene is exceptional. And in those situations, though, it's still essential to simplify, to really figure out what are the most essential components of the scene that you're looking at, and get rid of everything else.
Pixel Smooth in our chat room says, I look at that picture, I can hear the falls. And
well,
it's true. As soon as he said that, I went, yes. You can.
Yeah.
You can hear that roar. You're there. Much more dramatic than the postcard image. Yeah.
And is this a normal process for you? Are you walking up to these things and shooting it one way, or have you gotten where you're honed enough where you're not even taking that postcard shot initially?
Well, I hope I'm not taking too many of the postcard shots at this point. But sometimes it does take some work to sort of refine and find the composition. I don't know. You know, a lot of times I find that my best photos sort of compose themselves, you know, where I walk up and I go, oh, there it is, right there. And other times I'll find that, you know, something catches my eye.
Okay, enough with the falls. I hear them. You don't have to put them in.
So something will catch my eye and it just doesn't work for some reason. You know, there's a branch in the way. There's something distracting in the background. So I'll try different angles, but it never quite comes together. That's pretty common. Sometimes that just happens. You know, no matter what, you can't find the right
angle. Frustrating, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I was heartened to read something that Ansel Adams wrote one time about that, and he said, and I can't quote him verbatim, but he said something about that he usually, it's essentially the same thing, that he usually found that the images, his best images were things that he saw right away, and the ones that he really had to work on rarely ended up being some of his best. So at least we're not alone.
You know? Yeah. Well, we're a good company.
And then what you were saying earlier makes sense, where you're getting less postcard type shots because you're being thoughtful from the beginning. So
yeah, yeah.
Instead of just pulling out your camera and starting to shoot because it's, wow, it's beautiful, thinking, hey, what is making this beautiful? And how can I evoke the feeling I'm experiencing right now?
Yeah. And if it's your first time, you know, like, let's say it's your first time to Yosemite or your first time to the Grand Canyon or whatever it is, you know, by all means, take the postcard shot, you know, kind of get it out of your system, right? You know, take some of the classic views, even if the light isn't exceptional. And I think that, in a way, sort of frees you then to be a little bit more imaginative, to go beyond that once you've gotten the postcard, you've gotten the shot that you can take home to your friends and go, here, you know, this is what the Grand Canyon looks like. And then you can be a little bit more creative.
Risky.
Yeah.
Take some risks.
We're talking with Michael Fry. He is the author of The Photographer's Guide to Yosemite, which will be out at second edition soon. You'll be able to get it at Yosemite.
Probably a couple weeks. You can. When it's out, you'll be able to order it from my website. It'll be on Amazon.
MichaelFry.com with an E at the end. And this is also an iPad app, which is great.
Right.
If you have an iPad or an iPhone.
iPad and iPhone.
You can just put it on your phone and take it with you. Also of this book, The Digital Landscape Photography. Just really great stuff. Do you do much post-processing after you take an image?
Well, sure. You know, sometimes more, sometimes less. It depends on the situation. Some lighting situations are more challenging, where you might have to blend exposures together. You know, if it's too contrasty for one exposure, you might have to blend more than one exposure together to get detail and highlights and shadows. So those get more complicated.
Another good reason to have a tripod.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you bracket usually when you shoot?
Only if it's one of those situations I was just talking about.
You know ahead of time.
Well, I can usually estimate, but I also look at the histogram, and that will tell me whether I've got highlight detail and shadow detail. And if I can't, you know, there are lots of situations where if you expose a photograph properly, you should be able to get detail in both highlights and shadows. But there are some situations that are just too contrasty for that, where it exceeds the dynamic range that the camera can handle. And, you know, those are the situations where I'll bracket in case I want to blend exposures together later. I don't always need to, but sometimes I do, and so just in case I will. And you can look at a histogram, and that will tell you whether you've got shadow detail and highlight detail. And if you can't get both in one frame, then you can bracket exposures and take something lighter or darker.
So if you see the histogram, which you could turn on in the back of all the SLRs at some point and shoot, if you see the histogram falling off before the end on the left or the right, that means you don't have any detail at the bright or the dark.
You know, I can actually show you some examples that I brought about histograms here.
That'd
so,
and this is actually one of, I think, people's biggest, they don't know how to read a histogram.
I want to learn. This is great. I turn that on sometimes because at least I know if I've overexposed or underexposed. I can tell that from a histogram, but I'd love to know more about what I can see.
And
so there's the histogram in the lower left.
Right.
There.
So that's a really common thing. I know lots of photographers, very experienced photographers, who, you know, say, I'm not really too sure about what the histogram is telling you. But you know, it's a great piece of information that can really help you dial in the exposure.
So the one we're looking at is a classic bell curve. A lot of the pictures, the pixels in the middle, and then it tapers off on the left.
And the reason that I'm showing this is because I want to emphasize that it's actually not important at all what the shape of the histogram is. So this is that classic bell curve you're talking about. Here's another photograph with...
That's
not
hysterical.
Not a classic bell curve.
No.
But
for those who are just listening, there's a big spike... at the right end, and there's a little spike at the left end, and there's nothing in between.
Right.
Because it's
and
a very it's contrasting
image.
It's
kind of a two-tone image. Yeah. There's bright water, and dark. Which is what you're seeing in the background, the reflection there. And then some darker areas with gulls on a pier that are silhouettes. So there's essentially lots of light areas and a little bit of dark areas, and the histogram reflects that. There's a spike towards the right side, and there's a little spike towards the left side. But both of these photographs are properly exposed.
Right.
The most important thing to look at with the histogram is not the shape, but the right edge and the left edge. That's really all that's important, is the right edge and the left edge. So, this one, there's nothing pushed up against the right edge of the histogram. There's nothing pushed up against the left edge of the histogram. And same thing here.
That's what you want?
Usually, yes, if you can. If you can do that, and some situations are too contrasty for that, but if you can, that's what you're looking for.
In the situations where it is too contrasty, is that when you would do two frames?
Right,
merge?
I would do two or more.
And are you merging them traditionally, like through burning and dodging style masking techniques, or are you using HDR?
I'll sometimes kind of do it manually in Photoshop using layers and layer masks where I, take
the bright part here, the dark part
of that image. I also use a plugin for Lightroom called LR Infuse. It's LR/ENFUSE, and it's donationware, so it's cheap. It works really well. What I like about that is that it gives me very natural looking results. Sometimes HDR, and this of course is always a matter of taste, but sometimes for me HDR can look a little weird. And so, I want something that's going to give me something that looks natural. And
yeah, every one of your images looks absolutely natural. Yeah. You would never say, there's HDR.
Truly walk up
I hope
to the
so.
Scene.
Yeah.
So looking at this histogram.
So let me describe this one. This is like a camel, maybe. You've got a on the left, you've got a peak.
You're in trouble.
And then in the middle, you've got a kind of another hump, and then it's tapering off as it goes to the right.
Yeah, but there's a spike at the right edge.
Yeah, that's not good.
And there's something pushed up against the left edge.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm talking about, is the edges. So the spike on the right edge indicates, the right edge highlights, left edge is shadows. So the spike on the right edge indicates overexposed,
so
washed out highlights somewhere.
It's clipped in the in the highlights.
And the left side indicates clipping in the shadows, black shadows with no detail in
Some cameras will actually flash where it's clipped on the image.
Yeah, and that's a great useful tool also, the highlight alert that flashes at you, technically known as the blinkies, where it flashes at you. I mean, that not only tells you that something is overexposed, but it tells you what? How much?
Right.
This is a histogram with, a properly exposed.
So I'm not looking
contrast.
At the middle part. It doesn't matter where those peaks and valleys are. It's what's the left and the right.
Pushed up against the right edge, and maybe a tiny bit pushed up against the left edge, but that's okay. Now, as I said, there are some situations where you can't do that. There's too much contrast. Like if you look at this one, we have nothing pushed up against the left edge, but there's a little spike at the right edge.
I see it.
And if we made it darker, it would shift everything over to the left.
And then you have a problem on the left.
Underexposed shadows.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, this is one where the right edge looks fine. It's close, but there's nothing pushed up against that right edge. But there's something pushed up against the left edge, so we have some black shadows. Now,
that may not be a bad thing.
Right, may not be. Exactly.
Look at your composition,
very good,
I guess.
That's a very good point. I think in landscape photographs that if you have a high contrast situation, and no matter how you expose it, you're either going to have washed out highlights or black shadows, you'd rather have highlight detail and sacrifice the shadows than the other way around. I think, first of all, your eye, when you look at a photograph, most of the time your eye goes to the brightest spot. So
right.
If there's a washed out highlight, you're going to notice it right away. And
that's
it's
true.
Also,
you always see those burned out areas.
Yeah. And it's also not something we see in real life, so it looks unnatural. If you're walking around outside, you don't see washed out highlights. There aren't things out there that are so bright that they look washed out to you, unless you're looking right at the sun, maybe, or something really bright like that. So for those
on the
reasons,
other hand, we often see places we can't see into where it's just black.
Shadows,
exactly.
Yeah,
backlight, for
especially,
example.
Yeah, backlight or at night. Right. I mean, we're really used to seeing black shadows, so that seems more acceptable to us visually in a photograph to have black shadows. So most of the time, I'd rather see this histogram with nothing pushed up against the right edge, and if there's some black shadows, okay.
Right.
That's assuming you're trying to do it all in one frame. If I saw this histogram like this, I would also take a lighter exposure to make sure I had both. You know, one with shadow detail, one with highlight detail, and then I could, or maybe three or four, so that I could potentially blend those together later.
And I would guess you never use a histogram in a vacuum. You're always looking at the image.
Sure, of course. Yeah. Of course.
Well, I think, and that's actually a really good point. And I think a really important thing is, do not rely on the back of your screen.
Yes.
That's the biggest, no, well, seriously.
And I'm hearing Michael look a lot at the back of his screen, well, but if you know what you're looking for.
I mean, as far as exposure is concerned, do not rely on the back of your screen.
That's an important distinction. Yeah. That is so unreliable. I mean, because you can change the brightness on the screen, or you have light reflecting off of it, or it's really dark outside, and so the screen looks bright, but it really, you know, it's really
We do the same thing in the studio all the time. We'll look at monitors and go, that looks awfully dark, and Ryan will always say, don't look at the monitor! It's not reliable!
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the monitors on the back of cameras are
even worse.
Generally, pieces of junk.
Right.
You know, so they're not a great way to evaluate what the photograph really looks like in terms of exposure. Histogram is much more reliable.
So resist looking at it and pull up the histogram.
Yeah, absolutely. And the highlight alert, the blinkies too, because that'll
technical
warn
term.
You about overexposed highlights as well. So I don't know if you want to go on here. I have a couple
please.
More.
Yeah, please. This is great.
You know, I would say to make this really simple, most of the time, and again, I'm talking about landscapes, but most of the time you want the brightest pixels to be near but not touching the right edge. So, you know, here this is underexposed because the brightest pixels are not near that right edge. There's a big gap here. You know, this one is clearly overexposed. It looks washed out, and there's a big spike at the right edge. This one is properly exposed. You know, the brightest pixels are near but not touching that right edge. And it so happens that we have shadow detail too, which is great. Couple of exceptions to that. You know, if you actually have the sun in the frame, it's okay to have a spike at the right edge of the histogram and to have some parts of it blinking at you. That looks normal because if you were looking at the sun in real life, it would be too bright to see any detail in. Right. So that's fine. I mean, I think this picture looks properly exposed, but you can see that there's a spike at the right edge of the histogram. And this is Lightroom's version of the blinkies, you know, where it shows you washed out highlights in red. So there's some small washed out areas here. But again, you know, I think that's fine if the sun's in the picture.
It's very minimal, too, as well.
If it's really low contrast, then you don't necessarily have to push the histogram all the way to the right either. It could be somewhere in the middle or a little bit above middle, like this one is, where the histogram is really narrow as it is here. It fills up, you know, maybe half the space available. And if you're using RAW mode, then you can often get away with having small overexposed areas and be able to recover those in software later. So there's a few exceptions. But most of the time, you just want to try to push that histogram as far to the right as you can get it without all the way up
without
against
clipping.
The right edge. Exactly, without clipping.
And that goes back to film. It was always exposed for the highlights. I mean, that's
and slide film especially.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So.
You can recover detail sometimes from the dark better than you can from overexposed.
Well,
there's limits to either way. You know,
right.
You're right. You can often pull out a lot of shadow detail that's seemingly just black, but as Catherine mentioned, you're likely to bring out a lot of noise when you do that too. I mean, some cameras are better than that than others, so it's always good to know the characteristics of your camera and kind of how much you can get away with. And, you know, when I'm working with students in workshops, one of the first things I do is take one of their pictures and try to really lighten up a bunch, you know, some dark shadows and see how much noise do we get.
Right.
And, or, you know, find some overexposed highlights with a RAW file and see if we can recover those, you know, kind of what the limits are to recover overexposed highlights.
That's cool. That sounds like a good exercise.
Yeah.
You shoot Canon?
Yeah.
And is it a 5D?
It's a 1DS Mark
1DS.
II. Where'd it go? Oh, there it is.
It's over there. We moved it. No, we didn't steal it. We just moved it.
Yeah.
It's slowly being moved towards my car. I only have the Mark II.
Canon and Nikon are both great. I work with all kinds of cameras and workshops. And
do you ever do a medium format or larger formats?
You know, I used to use medium format film all the time, and I've never bitten the bullet and bought a really expensive medium format back. You know, the new Nikon D800 and D800D.
That's almost medium format, isn't it?
Are pretty tempting. Yeah.
If you had the money, is it worth the investment
to
go to the medium format route?
You know, even something like the Nikon D800, right? It's 36 megapixels. I think for most photographers, it's overkill.
Right.
You know, unless you make large prints, you'll never notice the difference. You
and
know,
large, for, like really large.
Like billboard size.
Exactly.
At least 16 by 20.
Right.
You know, you can maybe tell the difference in, at that size. But, you know, between a 12-megapixel camera and a 36-megapixel camera at a 16 by 20 print, if you know if it's done properly and you know and everything else is you know using sharp lenses and the camera's on a tripod and all of that, a lot of people probably couldn't tell that much of a difference even at that size.
Do you have a favorite 95%. Lens that you like to use?
Well, I probably use my 70-200 zoom more than anything else.
See, this blows
He's
my
killing
mind.
The myth. Yeah.
Just killing the myth. I thought you had to have a 24 for
lens. I have a 70-200 and a 17-40 and I probably use the 70-200, you know, 90% of the time.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
But if I look at my best photos, I would say, you know, half of them are taken with a wide lens. Mm. So, you know, I bring out the wide angle lens when the light and clouds and weather and all that is really good and really interesting. And so those are bound to be some of the better photographs.
So that's when you want to get more in there.
Yeah.
You want to get that scenery.
Me, that's when I'm
that
doing
that. Weather. Yeah, that's interesting. Makes me want to go to Yosemite right now.
Well, you have a guide.
it's hot right now.
Do you do workshops there?
Absolutely, yeah.
If people are planning a trip to Yosemite, they should go to your website, Michael Frye, FRYE.com.
Yeah, and they can find out about my workshops there.
That's almost worth making a trip to Yosemite just for that.
Sure.
What a great opportunity.
Sure. And many people do.
Yeah.
I do workshops with the Ansel Adams Gallery, mostly. I do a couple of my own, but
Full Moon Photography Workshop, July 31st.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
let's do it.
Coming up.
Nothing like the full moon.
Yeah.
Some tips for shooting the full moon. That's a tough one.
It is a tough one, and I have. I could probably find it here on my screen or somewhere, but I have on my blog somewhere, I have some tips about that, about night photography and about photographing lunar rainbows. That's a popular thing that people do.
You ever see a double rainbow?
Yes.
Just teasing you.
You couldn't resist, right?
Well, I mean, that's where that's from, right?
You know, I know. It's from Yosemite.
Just outside Yosemite.
Yeah. Look at that.
So is this one of the things you're doing to stay inspired? Because I imagine you're in the space that's gorgeous. How do you not
look at that? Now, these are lights, obviously.
Is this the exploring?
Yeah. Well, you know, they're showing on the screen some of my nighttime photographs. So, you know, I've tried to photograph the landscape in all kinds of different ways. You know, just classic daytime landscapes, which you've seen, as well as some of my nighttime work, which is kind of wild, like that one.
Yeah.
Where I'm using various, you know, lighting equipment, mostly flash, but sometimes flashlights to light things and create all kinds of wild colors and things like that. So, I mean, that's something that we'll be doing in that workshop that you mentioned, is doing light painting, you know, learning how to do that.
Let me go back to that, the petroglyphs. So this is obviously a timed exposure, a mm-hmm. long exposure, because mm-hmm. you can see the star movement. Are you then flashing a flash to get the petroglyph? Is
right.
That
yeah, I mean, that's the basics of it, yeah. It's actually probably a couple of... This was done on film... this image was maybe about 15 years old.
All the more impressive. You only get...
But it's a multiple exposure. So you know, camera's locked on the tripod, but I did a couple of exposures for the flash on the rock, and then I focused on infinity and opened up the shutter for another, you know, hour and a half for the star.
Hour and a half. Wow.
Oh,
jeez.
Yeah.
What fun. This is also great.
Yeah, I mean that's really fun. I think one of the great things about night photography, in combination with the landscape, is that it allows you to be really creative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can overpower the light because there's so little of it by adding your own. So that adds that element where you can light different objects in the landscape and kind of direct people's eye, or use gel filters over the light source to create different colors. You can create movement. You know, star trails are an example of that, or you know, moonlit clouds. You know, you don't think of clouds as being something you can blur, but if you're doing an 8-minute exposure at night, they can blur and create streaks and all kinds of things like that. So it can be really fun and creative. It's not You know, it's not for beginners, I don't think. It does take a little bit of technical proficiency, or at least, you know, understanding some of the basics. But digital photography makes it so much easier. And I find that, you know, teaching workshops on night photography, people really get into it and can learn a lot
really
in a short
fun.
Period of time.
Really
fun. And if there was a beginner that wanted to just experiment and try, what's a sort of simple entry point shot that they could go out and try to do?
Yeah, I would try something lit by the full moon. You know, could be, you know, a mountain or just any scene, maybe an ocean, any scene that's lit by the full moon. And, you know, one of the most difficult things is to actually focus at night, right? Because your autofocus probably won't work. It's too dim. And so basically what I tell people is usually you want to compose a scene where everything's distant. You know, you don't want to be trying to have something 5 feet in front of the camera and get that in focus as well as, you know, a mountain in the distance. You want to pick a composition where everything is reasonably far away. And then you essentially want to focus at infinity, but most lenses these days focus past infinity, right? So you can't just dial in the lens to infinity and say, oh, I'm good.
Right.
You actually have to focus it. So pick a bright light source. You know, if you can actually see the moon, just focus on the moon, either on autofocus or manually, and then put it on manual focus so you don't
refocus.
Tweak it. You can even tape the lens, right,
yeah.
so that it doesn't move. And just keep that focus point. So that's one of the first things is getting the focus right.
That's where I use that. Putting that focus button on the back is
right.
Very helpful.
Yeah.
Because then I don't accidentally hit the
yes.
refocus.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is real helpful.
Yeah. Do you do that?
Yes.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah, we're working on Catherine.
Yeah. I'm a slow learner here.
and then
you just got to steal my camera, Leo.
I'll set it for you.
It's about getting the exposure right. You know, so. And, you know, usually, God, I can't even remember off the top of my
head.
This
is a perfect example. I mean, what a difficult exposure.
Yeah.
That wasn't
too bad. And this is actually a daytime photo. So this is one of those little myths about, you know, moon photos. Most of the photos that you see, probably all, of like a moonrise or a moonset, moon above the landscape, are taken at sunrise or sunset, not during the middle of the night, because in the middle of the night, the contrast is too great. The
right.
moon is so much brighter than the landscape that you're either going to have a washed out moon
right.
or the moon's properly exposed and the landscape's completely black. So
gosh, I love that shot.
So you need to, you know, so moon and half dome, I mean, that's a great example. We talked
uh-huh.
about that before. Ansel
that was daytime?
Photograph. It was sunset. And, you know, his Moonrise Hernandez photograph is the most famous one. Again, that's another sunset photograph.
That makes sense, though. Once you
yeah.
say it, of course it's not right. nighttime. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It conveys nighttime, but it isn't nighttime.
Yeah, yeah. And the moon, I mean, the moon is a great addition to those kinds of scenes.
Oh, yeah.
It helps to create that kind of a mood.
Mystery.
I'm not sure what it is. Mystery,
yeah.
exactly.
Yeah.
With a shot like this, is there a particular shutter speed that you like to settle on, or is it just depending on the...
You know, usually if nothing's moving, and here, you know, the water might be moving a little bit, but not enough to be a concern, then aperture f-stop is my first consideration. So I want to pick an aperture that's going to give me enough depth of field to get everything in focus. Usually in landscape photographs, you want everything to be in focus.
So you're talking f11, 16, how?
Yeah, you know, f11, f16, even f22. You know, here there's not that much depth, so I wouldn't need a real small aperture.
Mm-hmm.
And then whatever shutter speed is going to give me the right exposure at that aperture. And you know, I do most of my exposures manually, but if you're using aperture priority, then you know you can do that.
How do you do your exposures manually? Are you using a light meter? I mean, you can't put a meter on the moon.
No, you know, I'm just using these days mostly the camera's built-in meter.
The meter,
and I'm using the histogram. You know, so the meter is a starting place,
right?
And then I look,
at the,
histogram
it, look at the histogram
and adjust if necessary. And if you have, which many cameras do these days, if you have, if you can see a histogram in live view, that is
that's right.
really nice.
That's
because
right.
you can just dial in the exposure in advance. You
perfect.
Know, you can adjust.
And trust that, not your eyes, not the meter
yes,
even,
exactly.
but trust the histogram.
Yeah. Hammer that point in.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I think light meters are outdated technology. You know, I mean, we've been using them forever. Photographers have been using them forever. And they're really pretty crude instruments.
Compared
you know,
to a histogram,
a histogram
you're
is
right.
much more accurate.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure if they put their mind to it, the camera manufacturers can come up with something even better. I don't know. But But yeah, histogram I think is a much more.
I'm turning on my blinkies and my.
It gives a lot more information.
Yes.
Michael, it's such a pleasure meeting you.
Thank you so much. Well, I appreciate all your hard
work.
Welcome.
And it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Makes me want to go to Yosemite. When you do, make sure you get the Photographer's Guide to Yosemite either on your iPad, your iPhone, or the printed edition available from YosemiteConservancy.org or Michael's website, MichaelFry.com. That's where you'll also find the Digital Landscape Photography Guide and his other books, MichaelFry.com. And the workshops and the full moon workshop at the end of the month. Wow, that would be fun.
Yeah, it would.
So nice to meet you. Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
We have one more Twit photo
next week.
It makes me so sad.
And guess what we're doing?
What are we doing?
The movie poster.
We've got the guys back from...
11D's coming back.
11D,
and
good.
They're going to be showing us...
Because I've been waiting to see our poster.
So we'll do it up next week.
Good. And then the good news is Catherine's going to keep doing Twit Photo on her own site. It's going to be a new name, which I love.
Photography Unfiltered.
Photography-unfiltered.com. And Catherine and Ryan Marsh will be doing that, and I'm very excited. And we're going to help you any way we can with gear or whatever. You just let
me know.
Thank you. I'm really thrilled that you're going to do
Thanks
that.
For giving me the...
I want you to
even
do
get
that.
To this place.
I want you to do that.
So,
and I know the fans do.
Oh, and I just want to say thank you so much to the community. If it wasn't, they're the reason I'm doing it. That's it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, do it for them. Well done. So next week, our last Twit photo from this studio, but it'll be back in another studio. Thank you for being here. Thank you, Michael Fry. Thank you, Catherine Hall. And we'll see you next time. It'll be Tuesday, around about 1:30 p.m., 4:30 Eastern. 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 2030 UTC on twit.tv. Stay tuned. Before You Buy is coming up next. We've got some good reviews.
Oh, is it coming up?
Yeah,
3 o'clock
Pacific, just a few minutes.
That's great.
Thanks, Catherine. Thanks, Michael. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.
I can say that one more time.
No, you can say it.